books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Read On, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival, featuring Vice President of RNIB, Penny Lancaster. RNIB Connect Radio sponsored this talk that we present almost in full on today's show. Penny was supposed to be chatting to Heather Sutty, who unfortunately couldn't make it. So today, Penny is in conversation with Janet Smith.
So, as obviously I think a lot of you will know Penny from her work as a model, a photographer, a television presenter, including, of course, her role on Loose Women. And of course, through her public life with her husband, you might not know him, Rod Stewart, I don't know. I've never heard of him. But her memoir, Someone Like Me, is a fascinating glimpse, and I feel a conversation with the reader that takes us behind all of those headlines. It's a very honest and reflective book about identity and self-worth and the long, long journey towards a sense of self-confidence. And we get to experience Penny's life and how her early experiences of feeling perhaps a little underestimated in her life and how that is juxtaposed with living in the public eye and the Penny that we, as viewers of her life in different ways, see her. And of course, we get to understand about her sense of purpose and her sense of service, including her work as a special constable and her support of organisations such as the RNIB and, of course, the King's Trust, which is one of the reasons we're all here in this space.
Foundation.
Thank you, Penny. So if I, you know, had let Heather do this, she would have got that right.
But you're right in the sense that we support the trust and the foundation. But yeah.
What emerges in the book is a portrait not just of a public figure, but of someone continually looking to define who she is and what matters in life. So we're going to have a conversation about the book. But before we get started, please do join me in giving a very warm welcome this evening to Penny Lancaster.
Thank you, everyone. So lovely to be here. It really is.
I realise as well that you actually are kind of colour coordinated with the cover.
It's those peachy glows. I kind of like to wear the tones of my skin. Blend in, because I'm 6'1", and I feel awkward sometimes when I stand out, but I can't help it, really.
I think that's quite an interesting point to begin on, then, because with someone like me, it kind of suggests that there may be a gap between the Penny Lancaster that we, the public, see and the Penny Lancaster that you internally feel. And I'm wondering if that gap almost was a reason for writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Growing up, I was, talking of height, I was not only the tallest girl in my year, but I was taller than all the boys. So that would make me feel particularly awkward. And I was picked on for that. I remember even one of the teachers would say to me, Penelope, sit down, you're casting a shadow over the rest of the classroom. So my self-confidence in me as a teenager, feeling really awkward about growing up and the sort of impression that I gave people. And so it wasn't until I started modelling that I realised that sort of height was a good thing. But it was my mum that always said to me, shoulders back, bosoms out, you know, be proud of who you are. But of course, for a long time, I was this string bean, you know, tall, lanky Lancaster. And I hated every second of it. And I remember eating as much as I possibly could. My mum would prepare a lunch for me, and I would eat that in my morning break, and then I'd go to the lunch hall to eat lunch because I was so skinny. I just wanted to gain calories and gain weight, and it just never happened. And then when I left school, I ended up going into the modelling industry, and I was told I wasn't skinny enough. So then I was this yo-yo. I didn't know. I had a very warped idea of sort of what I should be. So I would go on these very strict diets, like literally lettuce. And then before a photo shoot, I would have like salt tablets to try to strip any amount of water retention on the surface of my skin to give the appearance of being skinnier. And there was a lot of time where I was like, you know, who am I? And I sort of always dressed myself up and pretended to be something that I really wasn't, never quite comfortable.
And so how did it feel when you embarked on writing the memoir to begin to explore who you felt you actually are and that it wasn't external judgments or being told what you should do and how you should look and behave? You know, was it quite a cathartic experience?
Extremely cathartic. I've been into one therapy session that was sort of more recently, actually, was something that I had to confront, but I wasn't quite ready. After 3 hours of, you know, constant crying throughout this session, I thought, no, I need to revisit this another time. But writing the book made me strip back. I was my own therapist, along with the help of a ghostwriter. We would sit for hours and hours and hours, peeling back layers and going down avenues and roads less travelled to sort of discover and really develop ideas and theories about why I got to the point that I'm at. But I think the big turning point for me was in lockdown, like I'm sure lots of us rediscovered or had time to stop and actually look at ourselves in the mirror and say, am I on the path where I really want to be? I have this opportunity now to sort of change direction. And as well as the lockdown, I suddenly had this tremendous fear and anxiety come over me. I didn't realise, but it was the menopause. My doctor told me that I was depressed and put me on antidepressants. But it was the loose women that I was on the panel with, some of them a bit older than me, that said, Penny, this isn't depression. You need your hormones. You know, that's what's going to make you feel better. And sure enough, they did. HRT kind of like saved the day. So I was like, suddenly gained my strength again, but wanted to really carve out a path that I could really say that this is me. And bizarrely, I decided to train as a special constable. I did get the experience to work with the police up in Cambridgeshire in the TV show, and I absolutely loved it. And I had this sort of fantasy that maybe I could be a police officer. And then the realisation of, like, well, why not? You know, but people told me, well, you're 50, you're a woman, and you're a rock star's wife. Like, you can't. And I'm like, why can't? I've been told I can't, and I'm not good enough for a long time. And I just thought, what have I got to lose? You know, and I think when you get to a certain age, you don't worry so much about what other people think. You start thinking, what can I do for me? What's going to make me happy? Don't worry about what's going to please everyone else and fit into some kind of narrative or box. So I went and did the training. And I remember there was basic English and maths we had to pass first. So I was a bit worried about that, but that was fine. I got through that. And, you know, like, I think one of the biggest skills of being a police officer is your ability to communicate and your voice, the tone that you use with people and your amount of empathy that you can have for others. So I think what I've gained in my life experiences, particularly I would say as a mother and a stepmother, kind of bring me a lot of skills and opportunities to be able to help other people. And I've loved every second of policing and doing charity work. And in a way, volunteering and being a a special constable is another form of charity, helping my community, helping other people, giving back. And that's a huge part of my life that I treasure.
Yeah. I'm going to pull you all the way back from kind of pandemic times and where life is at the moment to childhood and your challenges in school. I mean, you were bullied, you were dyslexic but undiagnosed. And so you've spoken so beautifully about trying to find that space when people are telling you what you can't do or what you can't be or how you should be. But that started very early in life with people almost writing you off with the whole undiagnosed dyslexia. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that felt like to go back to that space and that young Penny and write about it? And was that quite difficult, quite challenging to have to think back to that time, which obviously was, you know, quite, there was trauma involved there.
Yeah, I think as a parent of, you know, my younger one who's still at school, both my boys are dyslexic, and it's a different world for dyslexics now. You know, we recognise and praise the differences that are actually positive. How we are very creative and we think outside the box. We're brilliant problem solvers. You know, all those kind of soft skills, the skills that I think all the workplace needs. rather than just, you know, having the answers to a question. And of course, life's not like that, is it? It's, you know, it's not one straight line. There's very wobbly lines. And if you don't know how to steer your way through that, like dyslexic people do, there are own challenges in themselves. But of course, I didn't recognise that. The teachers didn't understand dyslexia. I never heard that word when I was at school. It was just like, you're the dumb pile. You could sit at the back of the class, go and get distracted and look out the window sort of thing, and sort of forgotten about. I was terrified of exams, terrified of having to stand up and read in front of people, talk in front of people, because I was just labelled, you know. And you know, your parents tell you you're wonderful and you're great at this or that and you can do anything you want, but you're just thinking, I want my mum and dad. You're going to say that. So when a teacher tells you that you're not going to make anything of yourself and you're no good at this and don't waste my time, that's the messages that you end up believing. And it took me a long time. I would say for the perseverance of my parents, you know, and their being so supportive. And then when I finally met Rod 26 years ago, he also saw that I had so much more to offer and to give. And he said, oh God, when I first met you, you were so shy, you wouldn't talk, you turned down opportunities, you always said, no, I can't do that, I'm not good, no, that's not for me. And he would just say, give it a go, because I see something that you don't. And I believed him. So it kind of worked out in the end.
you mentioned how supportive your mum and dad were, but can you talk a little bit about that family life? Because it did feel like a very close family with your brother, your mum, your dad, both of whom kind of, I feel, gave you a real sense of a work ethic and giving back to the community that you're from. And do you think that very stable, supportive beginning was kind of a real solid grounding for who you became and how you've navigated marriage with Rod and blending families together, because you're also a mother but a stepmother as well, and that must have had quite a number of challenges.
Obviously growing up, I did have a very secure upbringing, very loving, supportive mum and dad and brother. I went through some traumatic things when I was younger and they were sort of my lifeline, and it built us even tighter and stronger. And I think I wanted to create that family for my own when I was older. So I felt like I had quite a lot of tools when I met Rod. And there were, you know, there are four mothers and eight children. And I was just 27 when I met Rod. So without having had children of my own, I had a lot to navigate. I had to really step back and be the diplomat and be the peacemaker and just be in the sidelines, be there if I was needed, rather than trample over everything and take control. And it was a struggle. It took a long time to be accepted, but I thought I can't be one person for one child and then another penny for someone else. I just had to be my true, authentic self. And that's the only way you can move forward, I think, because if you try and reinvent yourself, it's like telling a lie and then remembering the lie that you told that person. And are they going to, you know, it becomes messy. And then you're not trusted. So, you know, with honesty comes trust. And I think that's what's built this really strong Stuart clan that we have. And all the kids come together and it's a beautiful thing now. Mm. And I cherish that. But I think, yeah, with the struggles from the past, it has helped me have a lot of empathy for people and their individual struggles, because I think I'm very good at sharing, as you might tell. But I think what's most important about that is when I was younger, I felt alone. I thought I was the only one that had this learning problem. I thought I was the only one that was being bullied, the only one that has gone through a sexual assault, or, you know, you do feel like, why me? And because it just, I couldn't see another penny around me. No one else was speaking about their struggles. So by me sharing my stories, other people start resonating with them and sharing theirs. And then suddenly there's a connection. And like whether you're talking about menopause, that was never really ever talking about. And now not just women, but men are talking about it. And it just sort of makes life so much easier when we share those problems.
Yeah. It's interesting talking about menopause, IVF in the book as well. And do you feel that it still feels quite radical to be talking about those issues in such a public space in terms of women's health? Or do you genuinely feel that we're much more open and more understanding and our sense of the knowledge is there now? Or are we still travelling towards that point?
Well, I feel a lot of the taboos are disappearing, and the shame, I suppose, because it's a natural process. If you know, go through adolescence, and there's a story I do tell in the book about my younger son, who was probably 13 or 14 at the time. He was at home with a group of his friends. They were, you know, boys. They were in his bedroom, and I was tidying up in the bathroom, and I heard them saying, "Oh, that Miss Smith today, you know, God, she was moody. What was wrong with her?" And I was like, listening into this conversation, "She's not normally like that. And what came over her today?" So I popped my head in and I said, "Boys, how old do you think this teacher is?" "Oh, I suppose about your age, Mum, maybe a bit younger." And I went, I said, "Well, you're learning sex education at school. You're learning about, you know, girls having their periods and boys, you know, testosterone coming and hormones." I said, "Well, that's the beginning of the fertility journey, okay? At the other end, there's a thing called menopause. So while those young girls that you're in class with are gaining all of these hormones, that teacher that you were talking about might be losing those hormones. So when the young girls you're with are getting tearful and stroppy and moody, you understand it because it's a period that she's going through. You're taught that. But what you're not taught about is the mood swings that the older woman will go through because she's at the other end of that fertility journey." And they were just like that, kind of going, "Wow." And, you know, I'm sure maybe they would, you know, be a bit more understanding to their mum at home or you know, their auntie or something. You know, it's fascinating that they kind of wanted to understand that, you know, and having this discussion. And so it's not just about women talking to women. It's you know, talking to men and boys. And you know, we want boys to grow up respecting women and considering all their needs. I think that's also why policing is important to me, keeping the streets safer for women and children, and educating men and boys when they grow up about the insecurities and the safeguarding that women need more so than men when it comes to, like, walking home alone. You know, a simple step of a man walking towards a woman, even though they're completely innocent, it wouldn't take much to walk on the other side of the street, because, and just to understand the anxiety that that woman might be feeling, and that dread of being alone and faced with a man coming towards her. As innocent as that could be, there's still a lot of women that fear those simple things like that.
And that's kind of one of the openers of the book as well, that when you experience that complete fear. And that's a journey that, as the reader, I was anticipating one outcome, which is very different from the actual outcome. But it was this demonstration of that fear of what potentially might happen, which was a really strong start. And I'm interested in why that was the story that you wanted to begin the book with.
Well, yeah, when I was about 11 or 12, on the way to school one morning, I was going into school late because I'd been in choir practice the night before, so they allowed us to sleep in. But little did I know that that journey to school alone that morning, instead of going in with other children, left me very vulnerable. And I was chased under an underpass by a man who ended up grabbing me and pulling at my uniform, and it became very scary. I managed to escape and get to the school, and it was proved later that I was one of about a handful of girls that described the exact same man. And being the oldest girl, I was the one that was asked if I could go and identify him. And he had supposedly raped one of the other girls, so I got lucky. But it was very daunting. And then when I turned 17, I was a victim to a sexual assault while I was modelling with someone that I thought I trusted, because I'd worked with this particular male. And he ended up drugging me, and I didn't know what had happened. One minute we were having a drink, next minute I was laid face down and he was on top of me. I'm very confused, very scared, felt guilty, felt shame, never told my parents. So I think that story for me, those kind of vulnerable stories from when I was younger, were important to tell, because I think I could never really answer people when they said, why did you decide to become a police officer? And I was like, well, why not? But maybe it actually was to get justice for other people, because that justice was never found for me when I was younger. And so it's sort of like a mission of mine. I'm a strong, powerful woman, and I feel like I need to protect others.
I think it was, as a reader, it was an interesting starting point, because from the outside, we view you and you're beautiful and you have this amazing, glamorous life. But obviously, you are a human being, so along comes the mess, the pain, the trauma, everything that all of us experience every day. But what the book, I feel, gives is, yes, we get a glimpse into the jet set lifestyle and great parties and dodging back between LA and the UK, but there's a real authenticity at the heart of the book. And I felt a lot of that came from your descriptions of your friendships and your relationships. And these are people that you've known from being a really young child who are still your closest, most trusted friends. And I was just deeply impressed with how you've maintained those friendships despite how busy your life is and how diverse geographically it is. So can you talk a little bit about those friendships and how you've maintained them and what they give you?
Yeah, I think it must come down to having felt so vulnerable when I was younger and fearful of strangers and wanting to keep hold of, you know, I had my family, of course, but I was going to grow up and move away from my family. And I felt like I needed that thread through my life of consistency, someone that I knew I could trust, someone that I knew well, someone that knew me well. And one friend, Elizabeth, who I know since I was 5, and another friend, Katie, from when I was 12. And they were both ended up being my bridesmaids. And I saw Katie yesterday, and I'm seeing Lizzie on Monday. You know, they're a very strong and very important part of my life. They were there from the beginning and all the way through my life, and they'll always be there. And for me, that is a huge comfort. Mm. And it's like family. You know, you can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends, and having them with me makes me feel safe.
Mm. I think the other thing in the book that is very lovely are the photographs, because there's photographs of the friends. And these, some of these shots are very candid. And I'm wondering if you can talk about why you chose to include the photographs in the book, and particularly ones where, you know, we get to see you. We get to see you just after you've given birth, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, that's showing real honesty.
Yeah.
That you know, you wanted to reveal yourself, I suppose, in that way.
Well, I'm a photographer as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, photographs, every picture tells a story. Isn't that one of those songs? Yeah, I think because I'm a visual person, mm. and the word was always a struggle for me. I think you can tell a lot from a photograph, and maybe from the photographs that I decided to share. I always wanted children from a very, very young age. Mm. And my first child came naturally, Alistair. And then I struggled the second time round. Alistair said he wanted a sibling, and he particularly wanted a brother. So that turned out just fine, didn't it? And he also wanted his brother to have the same initials, so we had to work around that. Rod wanted... all the boys have got Celtic names. Mm. So as Sean and Liam, and we chose Alistair. And then Alistair said he wanted his brother to have the same initials, so we had to work on another A. There came Aidan. And he was 3 IVFs later, but I wanted, you know, my family unit, something almost to resemble the wonderful upbringing that I had, and for, you know, my son to have that brother. Mm. And their brotherly love is such a special bond. Of course they fight, but I know they have each other's backs, and it's this also their pride that they have of their father's Scottish heritage, and it's so lovely to see. And so yeah, I wanted to be able to sort of, even if you didn't read the words, to kind of see a little bit of my life and what it's meant to me through those few photos that are in there.
Mm. And one aspect of the book which won't translate because of the visual aspect is when you did the audiobook. And we were speaking earlier, and Penny described, because obviously she's dyslexic, described that process for her of reading the audiobook. And it's so lovely. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. And also kind of going back to the beginning of what you were saying about the importance of your voice and the book giving that voice. And I thought it's so nice that you've chosen also to read the audiobook, because then it is literally your voice telling the story.
I know. I surprised myself, because when I was asked to do that, I was shocked. I was like, there's one thing, you know, writing my story down, but there's another thing reading it. And you'd think, well, hang on, you know your story, they're your words, just read them. But of course, when you're doing an audio, you have to read every word as they come off the page. And as a dyslexic, you're often flipping words over, or you're missing lines out, or you're adding ad-libbing. Because if you get stuck on something, or you can't quite pronounce a word properly, then you make it up, and you know, you just fumble your way through. So there's one thing being able to express myself and use vocabulary that I've learned along the way to actually reading the words off the page. And I was like, oh, God, this is embarrassing. How am I going to... But of course, my publisher knew I'm dyslexic and the whole process was going to be difficult. But, you know, the font on my book as well, I was very careful to consider not just sort of, well, mainly dyslexic people that sort of struggle. Because I love books. I buy lots of books, but I never either have the chance or, but when I do, it's just very hard for me to read through the first chapter. So for me, every word has to have a slightly larger space in between each word, and then in between each line, that has to be slightly wider so that I can really define each word. The letters can be, of each word could be, you know, as close together as a normal word would be, but just creating that extra space, then I can see the words as they are and they don't mingle and mush up. But reading it, that was a challenge. But we were at the R&IB recording studio, and having been introduced to the R&B from a very young Penny when I first met Rod, and a vice president of that charity, it kind of meant a lot to me to be in that space. And I thought kind of I owed it to them and to myself to give it a go. And, you know, worst thing, they'd have to go, Penny, nice try, but I think we'll find someone else. But I got through it, you know. And there was a producer there in another cubicle listening to me, and I found like I was sort of stuttering to start with, and then I was reading quickly and then I started reading slowly. But eventually I found my pace and my rhythm, and it was odd because it was almost like I was reading someone else's story. And then as I'm reading, I'm thinking, Katie, that's right. I mean, yeah, because of course it's my friend. So I'm thinking, no. But it was a bizarre experience, but I really, really enjoyed doing it in the end. And it was very cathartic.
Well, reading it once you've actually written and published it is one thing, but considering the dyslexia, how did it feel when the publisher first approached you and asked you to write something? Did you have a sense of the story that you wanted to tell? Did you understand the process that would entail for you? I mean, how did that feel?
Well, it was I kind of... About 10 years ago, I was first asked, and I was like, oh, no way. I'm not even going to have the meeting. This is just out of my depth here. One, I didn't think I had a book in me. Mm. Was I worthy of writing my story? I didn't feel like I'd got to the point where I had enough to offer people. And in that last 10 years, I'd sort of, as I say, found myself and found my true... purpose, and I understood me. And so I thought, now I can express that to others and hopefully resonate with people and help them through their little kind of wobbly journeys. And so when they finally kind of had the meeting, and I talked to different publishers with my agent, and I wanted to find someone that was quite nurturing, someone that wasn't going to tell me how they wanted my book to feel or look or which direction they wanted me. I didn't want publishers to say, right, we want to know all the stuff about you and Rod and this and that. And oh, don't worry about you when you were a kid. I wanted to be my true, authentic self. And they gave me that freedom to go in whatever direction I wanted. And covering all the different aspects that I knew that so many people would relate to and see themselves in it. Mm. And for me, that connection was really important.
And did it give you... a different sense of yourself when you were writing it?
It did, you know, just when I thought I was in a place in my life where I knew me. When you start writing a book and you tear about those layers about the person you are, and it brings up so many more questions, and you go off in one direction and you think you know the answer to that, but actually... No, hang on a minute. No, I was, and I was with this person, and then that happened, and that's probably why. And I remember the stories kind of changing direction all the time and having to rewrite certain sections and moving forward and coming back to them later. And it was a wonderful experience and process.
And obviously we're introduced to your family, your children, to Rod, to your brother, your friendship group. And how did they all feel when you started to write it? And how were they happy to be included as kind of characters in your story?
Yes, I mean, of course, they're a huge part of my life. I didn't want to delve into too many personal details about them, but I wanted the essence of what they meant to me and how I'm turned out to be who I am because of them, how they influenced me and supported me. So more about the impact they had on me rather than them as individuals. I was quite conscious about not wanting to leave someone important out or, you know, offend someone that I hadn't spoken about. And that, you know, I always feel guilty about those kind of things. You know, I want to please everyone, but you can't do that all the time.
I think what's coming across is who we see sitting here is someone who's incredibly successful, but there's this sense of so much self-doubt, and I'm wondering how you balance such a public-facing career and career choices, Penny, because you could have gone in a different direction. You could have been a police officer and not on the television or married to a rock star. So was it serendipity, or was it conscious decisions of, I doubt myself, but I am going to do this because I need to do this.
I don't know if it's a trait of dyslexics. Maybe I've got ADHD. I've never looked into that part of it. But somehow I do have a tendency to leave things to a bit of a last minute. But there's something about the anxiety and the nervousness about having deadlines and leaving things to the last minute that kind of, I work at my best. So when I'm pushed to the edge and given a challenge and almost having that little bit of fear, kind of makes me tick. So when there is a challenge in life, and when there's an opportunity to open a door into an area and into an arena that I've never ventured before, there's something that kind of turns me on about that. It's something really exciting that kind of, I've never wanted to sort of just do the run of the mill thing. And so it's that daredevil in me that sort of kind of goes, well, you know, I'm going to give it a go, and I might fall on my face, I might be laughed at, but, you know, I've gone through some of that when I was younger, you know, whether it was bullying. I've come across adults in my life that have bullied me, and I feel like, go for it, because I feel like I've got the tools for that, and because of what I've experienced when I was younger, that I can kind of face those things, and I love a challenge.
And it does feel that this is a book that we're only getting, it feels like part one of Penny's story. So I'm wondering if there is a thinking that you might return to your own story in some future date and kind of explore, I don't know, the next two decades or something, or there's another angle that you want to write about.
I never felt like writing a book was going to be, right, that's it, tick that box, write the book, on the shelf, done. I always felt like the stories that I told are more like adventures, whether it's the charity work, whether it's the police work, whether it's my love of nature. I always felt like the book would have legs, and somehow I would focus more on one particular sector and just explore that more often. I haven't decided which one of those yet and if that is going to be the case, but I do feel like I could dig deeper into some of those areas.
Yeah. I do want to talk very specifically about where we are here at the beautiful Dumfries House. And you have a relationship with this house already, and you were here relatively recently.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that relationship with this place, and also what will be underneath us soon as well?
Oh, yes, of course. Well, my husband and I have been ambassadors for the King's Trust for many, many years. And then when we were introduced to the King's Foundation, we were thrilled to be ambassadors because it sort of really encompasses everything. The trust being the young people in the community and supporting them who have lost their way, and giving them a second chance, giving them skills to be able to go out into their community and be productive. And then the foundation, of course, looks after the community and the environment around those young people. And having visited all of the projects that they do here with the foundation, all the skill sets and the work about nature and your environment and how people can live in harmony with the world around them, it sort of just answers and ignites all the things that I believe in. So, you know, Rod and I, it's very important for us to give back and do charity work, but it has to be areas that you're passionate about, that you're connected to. Otherwise, it's not authentic, and people aren't going to really believe you and your story and why you would support that particular area. So it's been a great pleasure of mine to come here and look at the wonderful work that the foundation has been able to produce and pass on to young people. And of course, our relationship with His Majesty and the Queen has been a wonderful one, a very personal one. Rod sung at His Majesty's 60th birthday, and he made a promise to have a dance with him at the end of the evening, which was quite amusing. It happened to be, "Do you think I'm sexy?" and then becoming a police officer, I was there on duty at the King's coronation.
Oh, wow.
And that was absolutely a true honour.
Yeah.
All in all, so it's sort of all come in full circle. In fact, when we do awards for the foundation or the trust, and the King comes along and you're introduced to him and the recipients of the awards, he always says, "Do you know she's a special constable? You do know that, don't you?" That goes telling everybody.
And you put something into his time capsule.
Yes, that's, there was a time capsule.
Metaphorical, that's actual.
Yeah. Well, I know the King is of love of nature, and of course bees are the centre of that, and honey. So we have our own honey hive. So we put some of our honey in, and I think there's still time to put a little extra something that we're sort of working on. But
amazing!
Yeah, it's special to be a part of.
Yeah, and that time capsule will be buried here, mm-hmm. and then opened in 100 years.
100 years.
Yeah. So I'm now going to open up to questions from all of you. So if anyone has a question or a thought, then got one right here. Microphone coming in your direction. It's little Reese. Hi.
Hello, Penny.
Hello, what's your name?
George.
George, nice to meet you, George.
George Burns.
Ooh.
Scottish name. My question to you would be, what is Penny Lancaster's next step?
Next step. Well, good question. It's a hard one because I never planned too far in advance. And other than organising Rod's tour and organising the children's holidays and those kind of household mum things, I do like spontaneity. And I think if I put myself out into the world and open myself up, and keep forging forward and giving as much as I can and learning at every opportunity that there is, that things will come by, you know, and come in my direction, and I grab opportunities. I love nature, and I kind of love the idea of maybe having a TV program involved in nature. You know, with everything going AI, I kind of feel this gravitation to sort of things that are more natural and true and tangible. So maybe something like that.
Mm. I'm very curious about you being a special constable.
Yes.
Pretty unusual. Do the public recognise you? And if so, how do they react to you?
That's a great question. I'm really proud to be serving as a special constable in the City of London. The City of London, as you might know, is the square mile in the financial district. So it's around St Paul's Cathedral and Liverpool Street, and it also includes the bridges. And when I first started my duty, it was during lockdown. So sadly, we were called to the bridges a lot with suicide thoughts. So that's sort of where I sort of feel I come into my own when I'm dealing with victims. Because I think when you think of police officers, you think police and criminals and chasing suspects. But you, as a frontline officer like I am on foot patrol, as a special, you're expected to do 200 hours a year, which works out about one duty a week. And including things like the Lord Mayor's Show, Remembrance Sunday. And 2 weeks ago, I was on duty for the London Marathon, based on Tower Bridge. But you do come face to face with members of public all of the time. Sometimes they're just asking for directions, but sometimes they're asking for help. Whether it was a young lady who was fearful that she was being stalked, or a man that was wrapped rosary beads around his hand saying that he had suicidal thoughts. So I feel that as a police officer, whether you're on the street and it's a quiet night, which is the key word you're not meant to use as an officer, because it's sure enough to get busy. But even those nights that I'm not dealing with much, I still feel like I'm making a difference, because just that police presence, not only does it make the members of public feel safer to see the police officers around, the presence of a police officer will also deter crime, just having that presence. So we do a lot of charity work, but I've always felt like I needed something more tangible, something I can get my hands on. And policing for me, just when I thought I was giving something to my community, what I get back in return is tenfold. Most of the time people don't recognise who I am, because I think that's the kind of sad thing. That I think as a police officer, and in my position, I'm trying to sort of highlight the work that police officers do, and that we are humans. Behind the uniform, which most public see, is just, they see the police force, they see us, a uniform's coming towards them. Mm-hmm. They don't see us as a mum, an uncle, a brother. We're just, There's the saying that Robert Peel, who began the first ever police force, he would say, the public are the police and the police are the public. And we are. Mm-hmm. We're just members of the public that choose to put the uniform on and do that duty. And as a special, we volunteer. We have 9-to-5 jobs and we have families. But in our spare time, we want to give back, and that's the way we choose to do it. There was one time when I was dealing with a lady who had fallen over. She'd had one too many drinks and almost got run over by a car. Me and two of my colleagues helped pick her up. And she said, "Well, don't waste your time with me. I'm going to be fine. You've got much better, more important things to be doing than looking after a drunk person. I'll get my way home." It's like, no, sorry. But part of our duty is to make sure that you're safe, okay? If we were to walk away and then you did get hit by a car, then that would be back on us. So we'll just wait with you, madam, okay, until your friend, boyfriend, whoever comes and picks you up. Anyway, she said, "He'll be here in 15 minutes. That's fine, we'll wait with you." So we started chatting. And all of a sudden she said to these colleagues I was with, male officers, "I've just remembered. Penny Lancaster, police officer with the City of London, isn't she?" And they were like, "Yeah, she is. Have you worked with her before?" And they were like, "Yes." And she said, "So is she nice?" "Oh, she's really, really nice." And I was thinking, "Oh, God, what's she going to say about me?" And then she said, and then they turned around to her and said, "So you've not bumped into her, because obviously you work in the city. You've not seen her before?" "No, I've never seen her before." And yeah, "Are you sure about that?" And then she's looked at me and she looked again. She went, "Oh, my God, it's you." So there was me with my hair scraped back, no makeup on, in this kind of huge uniform and dab vest that we wear. And no, I wasn't recognised. Which is quite useful, and I quite like it, actually. I love that incognito thing. Going into the station and putting my uniform on, I feel like it's me being going in disguise, and people just treat me as a female officer, not as Penny Lancaster or anything else. And I quite like that. It's sort of like, I don't know if you remember that cartoon, Mr. Ben. He used to go into that shop, fancy dress shop, and go into the dressing room and as a spaceman or a cowboy and go out the back. And there we were. Sometimes that's what I feel like when I, get my police uniform and now I'm suddenly a police officer. I'm not all the other things that Penny has, all the other hats. And I really enjoy that part.
I imagine you have to be quite focused as well, so you can't let all the other thoughts in.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, Rod does say that my policing does trickle into our family life. Because he says, I'm a bit more argumentative and I'm a bit stricter with the boys and, I don't take any nonsense. I don't think that's too much of a bad thing.
It's your transferable skill.
Yes.
Another question.
Hi. You mentioned about bullying when you were younger and in your, later life. What would you say to somebody that's been bullied, whether it's a young person or someone in a later life?
Well, it's a message that my mum used to give me that I apply even to this day. And I think it's very hard to come to terms with when you're a kid, when it feels like torture, and you haven't got the emotional intelligence to kind of understand your place in the world. But my mum taught me early on, I know you're upset, darling, and I'm not saying you can't feel that sadness, but you need to be able to turn it around, because there's a reason why that person has bullied you, not because of you, but it is actually because of them. Mm. There's something that they're missing in their lives. There's something that they're unhappy about. And somehow by, putting on you, by deferring that unhappiness to somebody else and seeing that misery and sadness in someone else somehow lessens what they're going through. So if you can possibly look at that bully and feel empathy and somehow feel sorry and question, not why am I being bullied, but why are they bullying? Mm. And turn the question around, what's wrong? Are you okay? Sort of like turn the mirror around, let them see their own reflection. And so I learnt that in adulthood as well, being bullied as I'm older by certain individuals that I have, two of them I mentioned in my book. it's something that they're lacking, that they're missing in their life. It's a smile in the face of ignorance, and somehow it kind of makes you feel a little bit stronger, because it's not you, it's them.
Mm. Yeah, that's very good. We've got time for one final question. Who would like to... Oh, just over there. Hi.
You spoke earlier about comments made about your weight while you were still modelling. Do you think, although it's far from perfect, do you think the modelling industry now has got better?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I think there's tremendous pressure on having to be a certain look, a certain size. If you don't fit into this category, then you're not good enough. I was lucky that eventually I found my niche. And I felt my little comfort zone, and they were like buffers, and I knew that I couldn't go into that area or, but I mean, I think we see so often now as well on social media and Instagram, the pressures that body weight is still having, where we know that Ozempic was designed for people that were obese and having serious health issues because of their weight. And now it's trickled down to people wanting to lose that extra half a stone, and it's a very, very slippery slope, and it's a very unhealthy view that so many people have about this design, this image of what's supposed to be beautiful, and not really taking care and nurturing themselves in the right way. So I think it's sort of been exacerbated, really, because it was just in that fashion industry, but now it seems to have spread into normal society.
Yeah, that's true. And there, we're going to have to draw things to a close. Get hold of the book. I urge you to do so. And it's full of fascinating, funny, empathetic, kind anecdotes and gives a real sense of who the penny behind the headlines is. And I swear you will just want to be her best friend.
Thank you so much
so
for
thank you
coming.
So much, thank Penny. You.
If you have a question about sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is there for you. From using your mobile to being more mobile, from making celebrations accessible for all the family to simply making a cake, we're here to help. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or ask your Amazon smart speaker to call the RNIB helpline.
And just finally, I asked Penny after the talk about her first time public speaking, which is about 20 or so years ago at an RNIB gala dinner.
Yes, that was my first experience really speaking publicly. Speaking in a classroom in front of my teacher and other fellow students was terrifying, and nobody understood what dyslexia was when I was at school, teachers just thought that you were dumb. And so the idea that someone was asking me to represent their charity and talk in front of all those people to encourage everyone that was there, some 200 or 300 people, to dig deep and give their money for this amazing cause, I didn't think I was capable of doing the job. But my husband, Rod, said absolute nonsense. you talk the truth. You're honest and refreshing, and people will believe the words you say because they come from your heart. And it's that honesty that's not going to... You're not going to be robotic. You're going to speak from the heart. And so to just... You've been to the school, you've met the children and the staff, you can speak from a true perspective, and just go for it. And so I did. I got very emotional while I was telling the story, because of course there were some very emotional stories to tell about the children and the families that the RNIB look after. But I focused on them and not myself, and got through it. And in the end, I don't think there was a dry eye in the house.
Thanks to everyone at the Boswell Book Festival. We'll have much more from Boswell coming up in future editions of Read On. And a final thanks on today's show once again to Janet Smith and RNIB Vice President Penny Lancaster.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.